Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to City Lights Bookstore this evening. Tonight, W. Jason Miller will be presenting his book to us, Origins of the Dream, Hughes's Poetry and King's Rhetoric. For our podcast listeners, if you're interested in this book or any number of other titles, please visit our website at citylightsnc.com. Please help me in welcoming Jason Miller.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here. Thank you, Michael, for greeting me, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about this connection between two African-American icons, Langston Hughes and Dr. Martin Luther King. Now, Dr. Martin Luther King was an incredibly astute man. I mean, he could break things down for you dialectically, dialogically, or syllogistically. He could speak a polysyllabic psychobabble so fast it could make your head spin, and he could fill it with anaphora, epistrophe, or medial caesura. And as for words, he could put in sounds that varied from sibilants to diphthongs to stops to even what we call the breathlessness of voiceless fricatives. However, when Dr. King spoke the most, what he liked to do is kind of put his audience at ease. And so this famous speech we'll be talking a little bit about tonight, Dr. King reassured his audience that things were all right, but he was pointing towards a sense of humor. He had a flight from Atlanta to Raleigh because he was going to speak in November of 1962 in the small town of Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And Dr. King started his speech that night, which lasted for 55 minutes in front of an audience of about 1,800 people, by reassuring the audience that though it was an incredibly bumpy flight, he had made it okay. And he said, in fact, it was so bumpy and scary at times that he started to worry. And he saw the audience react and he said, "But I don't want to give you the wrong impression. It's not that I didn't have faith in God in the air. It's simply I've had more experience with him on the ground." So with that, Dr. King was ready to leap into one of his most remarkable speeches that he would deliver for us. Less known, sometimes, is the poet Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes was born in 1902 and is long considered one of the leading figures of the Harlem Renaissance. Some people who know would say he was the leading figure of the Harlem Renaissance in the late 20s and 1930s because he wrote the key statement of the period called The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain. And it defined once and for all that African Americans should embrace their culture and speak in dialect and embrace everything about themselves and not try to homogenize themselves and Americanize themselves and write sonnets like William Stanley Braithwaite was doing. Speak the blues, right? Be what we are. Europe knows our blues are important. Pretty soon America will too. But what's quite amazing is that Langston Hughes didn't die until 1967. That's only 11 months before Dr. King's assassination. So in most of our imaginations, we forget that these two men not only coexisted, but they knew each other, shared letters, spent time together, and spoke on numerous occasions. And so this connection reminds us that Langston Hughes's poetry is actually as important to the civil rights movement as it was to the Harlem Renaissance, and I'll explain a little bit why. So, very briefly, Dr. King was inspired by many different things, but one of the things that is at the very roots and the earliest part of his ministry and his public speaking was his connection very directly to Langston Hughes's poems. So Dr. King comes on the scene for us in 1955, and then he leaves us in 1968. From the very beginning of this time, he is using Langston Hughes's poems in his speeches and sermons all over the places. He used seven different Langston Hughes poems. He used Dream Deferred, I Dream a World, Let America Be America Again, Youth, Poem for a Man, and then he also used these poems like Brotherly Love, and he also used a poem called Mother to Son. Thank you very much. And the roots of this was because Coretta Scott King had witnessed Langston Hughes come to town and give a poetry reading when she was a teenager. And she was enamored of Hughes and loved him for the rest of his life. So she had every volume of Langston Hughes's poetry on her shelves. And so when Dr. King and his wife celebrated Coretta's first Mother's Day, he recited the poem Mother to Son from memory for her on Mother's Day to present her and think about the inspiration she would be to their first child, Yolanda. And so Dr. King wasn't just taking ideas from other people when it came to Langston Hughes. He wasn't just hearing a phrase like he did with a lot of other speakers like Benjamin Mays and other great rhetoricians of the day. Dr. King was physically and personally going to Coretta's collection of books, pulling them out, and looking through the poems, and then using them himself. Now, this is very rare, because most of the things that Dr. King embedded in his speeches and sermons were things he heard other places and just kind of picked up and parceled out. But it's very important to think about how deeply he knew this. So very briefly, these three poems about dreams are ones that inspired and can be found to be the roots of Dr. King's great I Have a Dream speech. So, the key motif in most of Langston Hughes' poems, even in the selected letters and the selected poems, is that of the dream. And Langston Hughes really, really spoke about this more than any other writer before him or afterwards. Dreams now are just kind of cliche to us. We think, oh, I had dreams and we have a dream, my aspirations and dreams. But Hughes was really, really profound in this area. He had a whole book called The Dream Keeper, which he talked about being inspirational in these ways. So, in 1959, Dr. King wrote his first sermon about dreams. And it said nothing about dreams being inspirational or positive or forward-looking. The title of the sermon was Shattered Dreams. And the thesis of the sermon was, who here has not been the victim of shattered dreams and blasted hopes? In other words, who hasn't had a hope and it hasn't come true? Now, what was amazing is I have this giant butcher paper at home. It's 14 feet long and 3 feet high, and it charts every connection between Hughes and King. And when I went back and I charted down 1959, I said, why is Dr. King using this sermon in April 5th of 1959? And so I started connecting. I started realizing right away, well, he was riffing off a Langston Hughes poem entitled Harlem or Dream Deferred. This is Langston Hughes' most popular poem. He said, what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? And Dr. King was reinventing that last idea. Our dreams explode, they shatter, they don't hold true. But the reason he was doing it then is because exactly 3 weeks later, A Raisin in the Sun had debuted on Broadway to immediate success. Lorraine Hansberry's play took its lines from the first line of Langston Hughes' poem, and it was such an immediate success that within 2 weeks it was already under contract to be a film in which took place. It ran for a record number of weeks consecutively on Broadway, starring Sidney Poitier, and it went so long that Sidney Poitier actually had to leave and was replaced by Ozzie Davis. So, Dr. King returns from India on this famous trip to the land of Gandhi. He also wanted to go to Russia, but it was not politically wise because it would have been a communist trip to learn about communism that would have haunted him forever. He comes back, and the first weekend is Palm Sunday, so he gives a Palm Sunday sermon. The next Sunday is Easter Sunday. The first free Sunday he has after Raising the Sun is when he talks about shattered dreams and blasted hopes. So, the first early connection of Dr. King with dreams is 1959, and they're not positive at all. But if we go back, there's two earlier ones. In fact, Dr. King personally requested that Langston Hughes write a poem to celebrate A. Phillips Randolph's birthday in early 1960. And this request was for a great celebration to take place at Carnegie Hall, and it was sold out, and Dr. King asked Eleanor Roosevelt to come, Hubert Humphrey to say a few words, and two leaders from Africa. They all said yes. But Dr. King's greatest excitement in his personal letters is that he actually got to a point where he heard that Langston Hughes was going to write a poem for the occasion. And so what happened was, you can see in the letters, he goes, Langston Hughes said yes, wonderful. Eleanor Roosevelt's coming, and that's fine.
Just a brief question. I'm not familiar with the name of the...
Sure. A. Phillip Randolph is long considered the dean of African American civil rights. And so from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, he was a leading figure. Even Dr. King, throughout the entirety of his time, would have deferred to A. Phillip Randolph. He was literally the organizer of the March on Washington. And so he's the one that got everything going. He's most famous for putting together what happened with the, it's called the porters. And these folks on railroad cars, the porters, would have a number of issues that came up in terms of their civil liberties in the 1930s. And A. Phillip Randolph actually threatened one of our presidents, I won't name him, and said that if you don't do something about this, we're going to put on a tremendous march on Washington to boycott this in the 1940s.
Wow.
The president backed down. This is called Executive Order 4402, And the president said, we can't have that in that particular way. So very, very important man, A. Philip Randolph. And yes, very often not known at all in this particular way. So it was his 70th birthday, and Langston Hughes says, yes, I'll write the poem. And so he writes up a poem, and you can see in the drafts he's excited about and thrilled about it. Dr. King is fascinated. But Langston Hughes can't actually be there to read the poem. He tells Dr. King, I'm going to be in California, I just can't be there. But I've been able to go through his actual calendars, and I found out the actual hotel room he was in the city of New York that evening. Ruby Dee, who was then starring in Raising the Sun, came up and read the poem. The very next morning, Langston Hughes wrote her a Western Union telegram saying how excited he was that she was able to be there and read the poem. And the question is, why wasn't he there? And it's an easy answer, unfortunately. Though Hughes was more popular than he would ever be in 1959 and 1960, this was also the time when Dr. King was under the greatest FBI scrutiny. And at exactly this time, in February, March, early April of 1960, a man named Bayard Rustin is sent out of Dr. King's inner circle for being accused of communism. Dr. King starts changing the way he starts talking and alluding to things, and he basically has to separate himself and distance himself from these accusations. And this lasts from April of 1960 all the way to March of 1965. And during that time, there are no references to Langston Hughes at all directly. What Dr. King started using is he started taking the ideas and he would start riffing on them, sampling them, changing them, but he wouldn't say the name Langston Hughes. So in the greatest period of Dr. King being in the spotlight, we can't see it. But everywhere before and afterwards, you can see it, and that's what the book basically documents in this particular way. And it's very strange these dates have this strong a start and ending, but they do. You can actually see letterhead from 1960 that has Langston Hughes' name on it, supporting the committee to defend Dr. King. And then when these things happen, his name is gone, and you can just put them side by side. And then the date is March 15th, 1965, captured very well in the movie Selma. Lyndon Baines Johnson comes up and gives a speech, and he ends it by saying, "We shall all overcome." And when he does, Dr. King is crying as he's watching television because he's realizing now the presidency has sided with the civil rights movement. And literally within 10 days, Langston Hughes and his poetry is back in Dr. King's speeches. And so it's kind of remarkable. You can kind of see this stop and start. So the third and final one is the most interesting. Back in 1956, scholars had long said that if you really wanted to find out what the roots of Dr. King's I Have a Dream was, you had to look through a series of speeches he gave in 1956. And they looked at this last section, they said, that's really the same stuff. We just don't have the phrase, I have a dream, but everything else is there. And so I went back and I looked at these and I realized that Dr. King was really in an intense moment of using Langston Hughes' works. Hughes had just written a poem about Dr. King, and it's hard for us to visualize, but in 1956, Langston Hughes was up here and Dr. King was down here. And being so much younger, Dr. King looked up to Langston Hughes his whole life. So he was in awe that such a poet had written about him. And within weeks, all of a sudden, all these quotes and references to Hughes' poems are in his speeches and sermons. So what I did is I took this last section and I said, you know, this is an oral moment, a speech. What if we broke it down as poetry and cut off the lines where there are all the rhythms and the cadences and even the sound repetitions? So I did that. And then I put it next to Langston Hughes' signature poem, one that's far less known. It's not in your collection that you lost. But it was the one he ended all his poetry readings with. The poem is I Dream a World. And what I found out was Dr. King rewrote that poem line for line in that speech. And so what had happened is Dr. King's ideas matched Langston Hughes. Now when you hear Hughes's poem, you're going to hear the repetition, the phrase, the cadence, the theme. Everything sounds exactly like what we know to be I Have a Dream. And so it's no wonder Langston Hughes said that he personally believed that Dr. King's dream was based on his own poetry. But he didn't share that widely because he was so proud of Dr. King and everything that it accomplished. But here's Hughes's poem. And when you hear it, you go, yeah. Langston Hughes in 1941 wrote, I dream a world where man no other man will scorn, where love will bless the earth and peace its paths adorn. I dream a world where all will know sweet freedom's way, where greed no longer saps the soul nor avarice blights our day. A world I dream, where black or white, whatever race you be, will share the bounties of the earth and every man is free, where wretchedness will hang its head and joy like a pearl attends the needs of all mankind. of such I dream our world. And so at the highest levels of rhetoric, we call this repetition at the start of a line anaphora. I dream a world, I dream a world I dream, I have a dream. That's exactly what Dr. King did with all of Langston Hughes's work. When Hughes said, dream deferred, Dr. King said, I have a deferred dream. When Langston Hughes would say things like, I dream of a brighter tomorrow, Dr. King would say, tomorrow will be brighter. And you can see all these movements. It's just like a shell game where he takes the words and he just moves them and hides them. And the levels of creativity grow over time and they become more unique and more personalized. But at their core essence, they're really just simply a remaneuvering of Hughes' ideas. So, 1956, Dr. King's rewriting I Dream a World. He takes this poem by about A. Philip Randolph, which is also about dreams. And on that evening of the event, Dr. King said A. Philip Randolph was a dreamer and had a capacity to dream. And then Langston Hughes' poem came up afterwards. It was a strange moment of what we call supersession or transumption, where Dr. King made it seem like it was his idea, but really Hughes had written the poem about dreams, and then dream deferred is there. Now what happens over time is this. There are three threads that form Dr. King's dream. The first one there, and the earliest, is that of poetry, and that extends dramatically. But the second is Dr. King starts realizing that for more integrated audiences, I can also bend it and break it in terms of talking about the American dream. So in of all places of Charlotte, late 1960, he starts saying the American dream is part of what he's talking about. And then the third and most auditory element that we now recognize in Dr. King's dream is what came in very, very last, and it's the prophetic element. And this didn't come until 1962, where they realized it didn't just have to be poetic, and it didn't just have to be about the American dream, but it could also tie into the minor prophets and the Bible idea of having a vision or a dream. No, this happened very, very late, and it's all three of those threads that it unites for various speakers, so the inner animating subjectivity of listeners can be such that they can hear what they want to hear. They can hear elements for the Bible, they can hear elements for poetry, they can hear elements from their own culture. So what's fascinating is this. This 1956 speech, I knew, had morphed into the March on Washington speech, August of 1963. What I couldn't find is the speech in between. I knew that somehow after rewriting that it had grown and changed. I had traveled to Boston University, Atlanta two times, Yale University. I'd read about 750 transcripts of Dr. King's speeches, listened to about 150 of them, and I couldn't find the transition moment. The craziest thing was the place where I needed to find this evidence wasn't in Boston or Atlanta, it was less than an hour from where I was living at the time, in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. So after mapping out all these incredible connections, I found out that Dr. King had spoke November 27th, 1962, in this little town, and I went to and found that there had been this historical marker set up to denote it. And I realized that to do that, the state offices had to have something there, so I went to the state offices, I opened up a folder, and they had a mention in there of a transcript of Dr. King speaking there. And I said, this hasn't come up anywhere in the scholarship. There are no records of it at all, nothing. And I immediately said, if there's a transcript, then there has to be audio, because you can't write down word for word unless you're playing it back over and over. So I said, where is this audio? We've got to have it. So I spent about 6 weeks just firing off emails one after another to any person. And lo and behold, what happened was a historical librarian in the city of Rocky Mount at the public library responded to my call and said, you're not going to believe this, but I have a box with an audio tape in it that says it's a tape. I've been looking for somebody to do something with it and help me out. Can you help me? So it went as smoothly as a duet between Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington. Perfect. And so what happened was quite remarkable. It's literally a reel-to-reel tape, just like the kind you see on FBI interrogation, when it's spinning slowly and someone's under the hot spotlight. And I took it and I said, whoa, the box had rust in it, the reel itself had a crack, and the end of the tape was frayed and turned. I'm like, oh no, what if this is what I need, but it's not playable? So I did another 6 weeks of research, talked to people. How durable is this stuff? What do you put it in? Mm-hmm. Who can I trust? All these things. So finally, I was led to a man with a strange name named George Blood. And he digitized the materials in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I said, now, why can I trust this guy? And they said, well, he wrote the book for the Library of Congress on how to digitize materials. I said, oh, okay, so everything at the Library of Congress. Yeah, he did the Robert Johnson tapes. He does the Boston Symphony. He does every Rock and Roll Hall of Fame celebration. He does
wow.
the Boston. Okay, we can do. So I call him up. And I said, George, I have this tape that says it's the first time. It's a very, very important speech by Dr. King. He said, oh, I do these kind of things all the time. Just throw it in the mail, send it up, and we'll do it. I said, George, no. He said, this is the first time he ever said, I have a dream. And he said, can you come Sunday?
He said, what?
Can I come Sunday?
Oh, okay.
So we drove up there as if we had some kind of buried treasure in our bag. And he was kind enough to meet with me personally on a Sunday. He went through the entire thing, and he didn't just transfer it. What he actually did is, in digitizing it, he had to slow down parts, speed others up, raise the levels, mm-hmm. and clean it entirely. Mm-hmm. Just the transfer process, there still would have been entire gaps in the speech, and the transcript would have just been filled with question marks and guess words. And we don't want guess words in a transcript. So, what we were able to do is restore that. After about a year and a half, I did an entire research. So now the 55-minute speech has 89 annotations to every single reference, allusion, biblical, poetic, otherwise, references to his other speeches. This is online. It's at kingsfirstdream.com. Kingsfirstdream.com. You can see photographs for the event, read the history. There's educational resources that teachers are using right now in their classrooms. There's a link to the documentary film we're making, and you can read and listen to the speech. So what I'd like to do quickly here is give you the key sample, the key section of the speech. This is the first documented time that Dr. King ever used, I Have a Dream. And why is it important? Because this is the revision of that 1956 speech with the exact same title and the exact same subject matter. So what Dr. King had done is he had changed it one more time to make it even closer to Langston Hughes' poem. Announcement that we had this tape. This was international press coverage news. I was interviewed on CNN, USA Today, the BBC. Articles were translated into Chinese, Japanese. It was in Australia. It was in the entire world. I think we did 13 interviews in about a day and a half.
Wow.
The phone was literally ringing off the hook. was one day where I literally was talking to the Washington Post, was interrupted by my office phone by the ABC Nightly News, which had this on, and then I hung up, and then CNN called for an interview. So the whole world was excited because this is, of course, the most recognizable speech in American history. But what's much more remarkable than that is we had a chance now to meet the people that were at this speech. And so a number of the folks that were teenagers when Dr. King came to town and spoke in the segregated Booker T. Washington High School, which still stands in the city, their lives have been changed. It wasn't just this memory they had from childhood. These people have become senators, like Angela Bryant, who's currently a senator for our state. Helen Gay, who was the first African-American city councilwoman in the state and now has a street named after her in the city for her community service and work. Mm-hmm. Multiple reverends who still serve in communities like Oxford and, oh, people like cardiovascular surgeons at Duke University. They all point to this moment and say, when I was there and heard this speech and this great man, I knew that I had to commit myself to something bigger than me. And they didn't just say that, they've done that in their lives. And so it's remarkable. The first event we did on this 14-city book tour, the son of the pastor who invited Dr. King showed up. And I asked him to speak, and he stood up and spoke for 10 minutes, and he said, this is what I remember about the event and everything that happened. I said, well, I have a few questions because I've been researching this for a couple of years. And I said, one, I know why your dad invited Dr. King, because they knew each other, but could you say more about that? He said, yeah, my dad, George Dudley, and Dr. King grew up on the same block of Auburn Avenue in Atlanta, and they were childhood friends. So when my dad took over as pastor in Rocky Mount, the first thing he did is invite his good buddy, the now famous Dr. King, to come. And he said, that's amazing. I said, that's amazing. I said, I knew that because that's why they were calling each other by the childhood names. He called Dr. King Mike, which was his given name to about age 13 until it was changed to Martin. But I said, the other thing I'm confused about is the mayor was at this. And it's fantastic because now we have photography of the scene and we've been able to identify all the people on stage who was speaking a lot about the event. And I said, do you know why the mayor left? Because I have record that the mayor came and introduced Dr. King, but then he left. And I was figuring, you know, as a white mayor, it was like, I need to be kind, but I don't want to be here, right? He said, yeah, I know why. Why was that? He said, well, halfway through the speech, someone came up and tapped Mayor Billy Harrison on the shoulder and said, there's a cross burning on your front yard.
Oh, God.
And so, you know, a lot of times our children are taught this idea of what this kind of discrimination was, like separate bathrooms, separate drinking fountains. No, so much more. And so this white mayor took a really tough stand at the encouragement of his own wife, who said, you've got to do this, even though you don't want to. And he had some serious intimidation and threats come against him, including going to his own home and seeing this cross burn. So what we're doing with this now is really exciting and unique, and I'm just thrilled to be a part of kind of telling Rocky Mount's story. So the next stages are that we now have a better understanding of why Langston Hughes on his deathbed wrote a handwritten letter to Dr. King. And it's quite remarkable because we have recognition of this, but what's fascinating is like this audio tape that had been missing for over 50 years, this letter can't be found. You can imagine how often we look for it. And through every different angle and avenue, formal and informal, and I've even been, and I've had great opportunities to try to learn more about it. But what's amazing is that this letter has either been destroyed by Dr. King, it has possibly been sold by the King estate, or hopefully it's sitting in Coretta Scott King's materials and will someday be found another 50 years, because a handwritten letter would have meant so much to her in this regard. But we imagine what that might have said about, thank you for using my poetry. Couldn't you say more about how you use my poetry? Or it could have been simply, keep up the good fight, because this is one of Dr. King's lowest moments in his life after he took a stand against the Vietnam War. And Langston Hughes never varied, as many other leaders did, supporting Dr. King. Even at lowest moments, Langston Hughes was a full-on supporter of Martin Luther King, when many leaders of the NAACP, like Roy Wilkins, weren't. Mm. So what we're doing next is really exciting. This is a documentary film project. We've already interviewed Ambassador Andrew Young. We did one of the last interviews with former NAACP National President Julian Bond. And this September, if you're close enough and within range of Raleigh, North Carolina, September 16th and 17th, we're hosting an exclusive event called Experiencing King at NC State. Friday night, we'll have actor Danny Glover and Felix Justice giving a performance, a ticketed performance of what they call A Night with Martin and Langston. Since the mid-1990s, these two really well-esteemed actors have recognized intrinsically the connection between King and Hughes, and they've put on a performance about Hughes' poems and dreams and Dr. King's speeches. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to invite them and tell them about the research and the actual documentation of that literal connection. Mm-hmm. We also have an internationally known painter named Cynthia St. James. She has put in exhibits in airports and embassies all around the world, and she's done this work that's been commissioned for us. Capturing her impressions of Dr. King and Langston Hughes and Jesse B. Semple. So she's going to be unveiling her artwork and signing prints for anybody that wants to be there and talking about her process. And finally, we have the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Dr. King, David Garrow, on hand. So he'll be talking more about a lot of those personal things in Dr. King's life. We'll be sharing the audio. People that were at the speech will be present. And then we'll be showing parts of the documentary film as well, and letting people know how this will be eventually broadcast on PBS and available for educational resources as we move forward. So a lot of exciting things with the research and the connection, and a number of things we're really excited about in bringing this to light. So thank you so much this evening for letting me tell you a little bit about how Dr. King became the star performer of some of Langston Hughes' greatest scripts.